From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, an economist's view of the GOP tax plan.
I think the word's going to get out sooner or later, and already has gotten out some, that most of the benefits of this go to people at the top.
The problem of kids lost in our foster care system and never found.
There are numerous cases where a kid has disappeared and a foster family has continued cashing checks and nobody even knows that the child is gone or missing.
Another Jumanji movie is opening. Michigan-born writer Chris Van Allsburg tells us how that story came to be, including the title.
I was set on finding something that was slightly exotic. Didn't sound like it was a word from the English language. And I think maybe the J attracted me because it sort of suggested jungle. And I don't know, it just sort of at that point sprang into my head, Jumanji.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The House and Senate have cobbled together their $1.46 trillion tax overhaul. Now the task is convincing Americans this plan will help them. Polls have found approval ratings for this tax reform bill at below 35%. Let's get the economist's take as we say hello to Michigan State University economics professor Charlie Ballard. Charlie, let's begin by hearing the sales pitch for the tax reform. First, here's the president talking over the weekend to reporters.
This is going to be one of the great gifts to the middle-income people of this country that they've ever gotten for Christmas.
And here's Senate Majority Whip John Cornyn of Texas talking on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
We're going to get the economy roaring back again and improve pay and increase jobs and make America more competitive in the global economy, as well as simplifying the tax code and giving everybody in every tax bracket a tax cut.
So, Charlie Ballard, as an economist, in your view, true or not, is this a boon for the middle class?
Not particularly. The vast majority of the benefits of this go to very wealthy and very high-income individuals. The big thing is a great big reduction in the corporation tax rate. And so who's that going to benefit? That's going to benefit the people who own a lot of stock. The average family doesn't really get a whole lot.
And GOP lawmakers and the president say, hey, giving that large tax cut to corporations that we're talking about here ultimately means more jobs and more money in workers' pockets. And Democrats say this trickle-down theory has been tried in the past. It has never panned out for everyday taxpayers. What are your thoughts on this trickle-down approach the Republicans are taking?
Well, the evidence is that trickle-down doesn't trickle down very much. These are benefits that are targeted at the very wealthy and the very high income and at people who own a lot of corporation stock. You know, indirectly, I think there could be some effect, but I think the effect is likely to be small, at least any time in the foreseeable future. In fact, I'm less optimistic. I've done some research on this sort of thing over the years, and I'm less optimistic now about this kind of policy than I would have been 30 years ago.
Why is that?
Because of changes in the corporate culture. It used to be, back in the 20th century, if a CEO got some extra money, he, and of course he is the right noun because it was almost all men at that time and still largely men, the executives would think about investing in plant and equipment. Today, some of that will happen, and that will increase the productive capacity of the economy. But an awful lot of executive today, the first thing that they think of is mergers and acquisitions, which may increase their market power and allow them to raise prices, but it's not going to do much for the average person. In fact, it may hurt the consumer. They'll be thinking of buying back shares to pump up the share price, and they'll be thinking of giving additional dividends. None of those does anything to improve the productive capacity of the economy, and thus they don't do anything to raise wages. The prospects for wages are fair, but this notion that all of a sudden everybody's going to get a $4,000 increase in their wages is just nonsense.
Is there anything you see in this bill that would be of particular importance to Michigan's economy, either positive or negative?
We're a sort of a medium tax state, but we do have relatively high property taxes. And if you have a large home with high property taxes, there's going to be a $10,000 cap now on the amount that you can deduct Also, fewer Michiganders are going to be deducting, are going to be itemizing their deductions anyway, because one feature of this tax law is that it doubles the standard deduction. And it only makes sense to itemize your deductions if your itemized are bigger than the standard deduction. Well, with the standard deduction going up, fewer people will choose to itemize. That is a simplification, and that's one of the aspects of this that I think comes down in the plus column.
Now, the president and congressional Republicans are touting how this bill will bring back corporate money and jobs from overseas. And certainly, as you and I have talked about so often in this program, Michigan's economy has taken a hit from companies moving overseas. Automakers and the suppliers have been doing it for years. In West Michigan, big companies like Perrigo have moved. Does this new tax bill, as you see it, motivate companies to bring profits and jobs back to Michigan and really the rest of the country?
It might do some of that. Bringing down the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21% makes our tax rate more competitive with other countries. However, one thing that I think needs to be pointed out is that the corporate tax law is not just the tax rate. Even at a tax rate of 35%, the old rate, lots and lots of corporations paid relatively little in the way of corporation tax because of various tax preferences, various what some people call loopholes. And as a result, if you already were paying little or nothing, which is true of many American corporations, then reducing the nominal rate from 35% to 21% doesn't really do much. So I think there may be some effect in terms of less of an incentive to park money overseas. I don't think that'll be huge. I don't think that'll be transformative, but I think there may be some move in that direction, and that's a good thing.
We're talking with Michigan State University economics professor Charlie Ballard, getting an economist's take on the new Republican tax overhaul. President Trump promised just a few weeks ago, and here's his words, we're going to eliminate tax breaks and complex loopholes taken advantage of by the wealthy. From what you've seen so far, has that promise been kept?
Not really. That makes a good talking point and a good slogan, but the fact is that the vast majority of the benefits of this law are going to be reaped by those at the very top. If you're in the top 0.1%, this is a fabulous bill for you. If you're in the top 1%, this is a very, very good bill. The average citizen doesn't get much. In fact, some ordinary people will end up paying more taxes. It's important to note that in order to meet with some of the arcane congressional budget rules, a lot of these tax breaks for individuals are scheduled to phase out after 2025, whereas the corporation tax break is scheduled to stay on indefinitely.
When we look at that long range, look down the road a little bit to when that happens, what kind of assumptions does this bill make for all of this to be able to be sold to the middle class?
Well, one thing that I think is worth saying is that this will increase deficits very substantially. Now, of course, Speaker Ryan has said that this will lead to such an explosion of economic growth that it will pay for itself, thus there would be no increase in the deficit. There's no evidence that that will happen. It may lead to some additional economic growth, but I think all of the evidence suggests that it will not be close to large enough to not increase the deficit. And at least some folks do worry about deficits. I know I do, and all of our other unfunded liabilities. So that's something that I think will make it difficult to sell to some parts of the American public. I think the biggest thing that makes it hard to sell, and I guess we'll see how this plays out in the 2018 elections, the proponents of this bill keep saying about how it helps the middle class. I think middle-class households will learn that they had, in some cases, modest tax cuts, in some cases, modest tax increases. But I think the word's going to get out sooner or later, and already has gotten out some, that most of the benefits of this go to people at the top.
We're talking about your concerns about the deficit, about the nation's deficit. So right. If we look at this balancing act of the promises of giving a boost to the economy and the worry about increasing the deficit, which side of that equation wins out in your view?
Well, in my view, we shouldn't even have been talking about a tax cut at this time. Just basic macroeconomics tells you that the time for big tax cuts is when the economy is in trouble. And sure enough, in 2009, the economy was in big trouble and we had some tax cuts. And all the evidence suggests that those helped to reduce the severity of the Great Recession. It was bad enough without those tax cuts. It would have been even worse without them. But then when the economy is in good shape, as it is right now, we're at or near full employment, that's not the time to step on the accelerator. In fact, many economists are concerned that the Federal Reserve will look at, here we are humming along in third or fourth gear, the economy is growing nicely without any fiscal stimulus, and now the Congress and the President are going to stomp on the accelerator with this fiscal stimulus. The Federal Reserve may respond to that by raising interest rates further than and faster than they otherwise would have. It's a very delicate balancing act that we have when the economy is already, you know, unemployment is the lowest that it's been in 17 years. This is sort of backwards in terms of when you should be cutting taxes. And then for the longer haul, you know, not everybody worries about this, but I will tell you that I do worry about we now have the federal debt held by the public is about $15 trillion. To paraphrase Senator Dirksen, a trillion here and a trillion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. And even without this fiscal stimulus of the tax cut, it's scheduled to grow by several trillion in the next decade. And this adds another trillion or trillion and a half to that. I am concerned about what we will leave to our children and grandchildren. What it looks like is we're going to leave crumbling infrastructure, a lot of debt. And remember, we currently pay about $430 billion a year in interest on the national debt. It's that low because interest rates are low. If the interest rates were to go up, as they may, that will mean that the amount that we have to pay to service that debt will go up, and that's even more of a legacy burden that we will leave to the next generation. And so I am concerned about that. I really think that we should be paying a whole lot more attention than we are to trying to balance our federal budget to reduce that burden.
Michigan State University economics professor Charlie Ballard. Always a pleasure, Charlie. Thank you so much.
Thanks, and have a happy holiday.
Up next, author and illustrator Chris Van Allsburg shares his inspiration for Jumanji. Then we hear what it's like to be the only black male teacher in a school. That's in 10 minutes, right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Hollywood comes to Michigan. The Michigan premiere of the new film Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, happens tomorrow in Grand Rapids and Ann Arbor. The film stars Dwayne Johnson, Karen Gillan, Jack Black, and many more names, and it was inspired by the work of my next guest. Chris Van Allsburg is the renowned writer and illustrator of children's books. He's won two Caldecott medals for his illustrations for the Polar Express and for Jumanji, which was published in 1981. He grew up in Grand Rapids, and he is with us now to talk about this new take on Jumanji. Chris Van Allsburg, welcome to the program.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
So I'm curious, where did you get that original idea for this board game that's magical with real animals and jungle dangers that players face in real life? Where did this idea come to you?
Well, I wrote the story as an adult, but I had recollections of feeling a kind of a disappointment when I played board games when I was a kid. I had decent imagination, but there was still something vaguely disappointing about playing Monopoly and not having real money, that sort of thing. And and so I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if there was such a thing as a board game, which did not require the imagination of the players, because everything that happened on the board game actually came to life, happened in real life. So that was the kind of starting point, and then I thought about different kinds of games, and I sort of hit on a jungle game because I thought the combination of jungle perils inside your house would be a provocative combination.
And now we get to actually ask the creator, where did the word Jumanji come from, and does it mean anything?
Well, it does now. It's the name of a game, but when I was just sort of, you know, casting around for a name. I mean, I was set on finding something that was slightly exotic. Didn't sound like it was a word from the English language. And I think maybe the J attracted me because it sort of suggested jungle. And I don't know, it just sort of at that point sprang into my head, Jumanji.
There you go. So it came out of your brain. And of course, we all remember the 1995 film version of Jumanji with Robin Williams as Alan Parrish. How involved were you with that production, Chris?
Well, in the development process, I was involved. There is, of course, this story, which is the intellectual property that is the book. And so that's a starting point. But in the short things that I write, obviously a great deal needs to be added. That happens through the development process and screenwriting process. So during that period of development, I was involved in contributing ideas about how the story might be developed. And then at a point, my contributions were, you know, taken away by screenwriters, and they wrote many screenplays and finally ended up with the Jumanji that we know.
And it's certainly one of Robin Williams' more memorable roles. And now we have this remake. What were your thoughts when you heard that there was a remake in the works?
I think maybe 2 or 3 years after Jumanji, they'd already set about trying to exploit the popularity of the first film with a sequel, kind of a financial model for Hollywood. But they struggled for some years getting a script that they liked, that they thought did justice to the first, was worthy of the name Jumanji. And in the meantime, I was working on a book sequel to the Jumanji book that I wrote. Because on the last page of the book, Jumanji, there are two children running off with a game.
Yes.
Identified as Danny and Walter Budwing. And so I, as the author of the book and with the rights to write a sequel to that book, and wrote a story called Zathura, which is a space adventure game. And so Sony liked that a lot. They went ahead and made it, and they sort of thought of it as a Jumanji sequel, but not really.
Ah.
So I guess about 3-4 years ago, the studio executives started thinking, you know, we haven't really tapped into the Jumanji enthusiasm that exists out there. Of course, a lot of the audience that saw it back in 95 is old enough now and they have their own children. Usually sequels don't come out that
much time span, yeah.
That time frame. But so they figure, well, that's great. Now parents will take their kids to see Jumanji 2.
And here we have it, Jumanji, yeah. Welcome to the Jungle. What do you like about this new version?
It's updated. It's no longer a board game. It's a video game. And I think maybe the most interesting thing about it is the use of a convention in video game design, which is that when people play it, they can choose an avatar. So when they actually play the game, they're playing sort of through the identity of this avatar of a character in the video game. So this is actually what happens to the four teenagers who play this game. They all end up drawn into this video game, but when they arrive in the video game, they do not arrive in their own bodies. They now inhabit their avatars.
And as a matter of fact, I'll tell you, I saw a review in the Wall Street Journal by Joe Morgenstern who said a lot of the fun is in figuring out who winds up as, you know, Dwayne Johnson or who winds up as Jack Black. And even Joe said, I'm not going to tell you, I'm going to leave you the fun of discovering
right. Well,
that.
Yeah. So the goal, obviously, in using a premise like that would be to make the most extreme contrast you could between the, you know, the individual playing and the avatar they inhabit. But the interesting thing about it is that it's a sort of collaborative effort amongst these four actors. But the four actors actually represent 8 characters because they not only have the character of the avatar, but they also have the character of the person they were before they became the avatar.
Gotta wonder, when you published Jumanji 36 years ago, would you have imagined 2 films, plus that animated TV show from the 90s, plus, as you say, you had the sequel film. Would you have ever thought that was going to happen?
Well, no. I mean, authors fantasize about the impact their efforts might have on a reading audience, or in the case of a picture book, a reading viewing audience. And you want to believe that it will find an audience that will be enthusiastically received. But it would be delusional to actually believe that, oh, the thing I'm working on now will, you know, generate a couple of films and it'll be around for years and years and years. So, no, I did not entertain those ideas. I am maybe not so surprised because it's happened slowly and gradually in my career, but I certainly feel fortunate.
Now, the Michigan premiere of Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, will be happening tomorrow, Tuesday, December 19th. It'll be at Grand Rapids Celebration Cinema North and the Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor. And you and your wife, Lisa, are going to manage to be in both cities as guests of honor. Good luck. Well, let's hope there's no snowstorms to clog that drive along I-96. And we should note all the proceeds from the Grand Rapids and Ann Arbor events go towards Joelle and Nyman Anchors programs for children at Hospice of Michigan and Arbor Hospice. Chris, could you talk a little bit about these institutions and the longtime relationship you have with them?
Many years ago, when the first Jumanji came out, my wife at that time was on the board of the Children's Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island, where we lived. And she had this idea that, well, you can actually use movie premieres not simply to draw attention to the film, but you could actually use this as a way of raising money and drawing attention to a worthy cause. And for her, it was the Children's Hospital in Providence. So she arranged this Jumanji premiere. It was a great financial success. And then when the Polar Express came out, we were contacted by Children's Hospice in Grand Rapids. They were very keen on the idea of trying a Polar Express premiere in Grand Rapids to raise money for the Children's Hospice. Hard to think of a more worthy and worthwhile effort than that. So we did this premiere in Grand Rapids on that occasion, got to know the mission of Children's Hospice and visited the hospital a couple of times, and since then have developed a strong relationship with the hospital and especially the hospice effort. And so I'm assuming now that as long as I'm blessed enough to have my books turned into movies, they will always be a premiere in Michigan for hospice.
That's wonderful. Well, you can get details on these Michigan premieres by going to Jumanji4Anchors.com, and that is the number four, Jumanji4Anchors.com. Chris Van Elsberg, a lot of us are going to be thinking about you and thanking you as we read and watch The Polar Express this holiday season, and now the new film, Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, with the Michigan premiere happening tomorrow night in Grand Rapids and Ann Arbor. Chris, thanks so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Experimentation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
Technology alone is not enough.
The teaching profession in America remains largely white and female, which means that young African-American males can go through school without really ever seeing a teacher who looks like them. Not only can this mean a lack of black role models, but it also means that teaching doesn't get held up as a profession desirable for black men to pursue. Today's guest on The Next Idea is trying hard to change that narrative. He's spent his career in education, and he's experienced firsthand what it's like to be the only black male teacher in a school. Dr. Curtis Lewis is professor of Henry Ford Academy School for Creative Studies in Detroit, and he's the founder and chairman of the Board of Black Male Educators Alliance of Michigan. Dr. Curtis Lewis, pleasure to welcome you to The Next Idea.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
When you think of what you've done in founding the Black Male Educators Alliance of Michigan, what do you see as the group's mission?
It's sort of leveled in three points, very important pieces. It is to develop an interest in younger black males. So we're looking at a pipeline issue here. So we want to get our middle school, our high school students interested in seeing teaching as an option. We sort of do that through our mentoring program, where we focus on cultivating the knowledge around what does it mean to be a teacher and why it's important. And it also is important for them to see black males in education, right? For them to see themselves as just being a viable option. Once we pique the interest, also to work with various organizations and universities in recruiting black male teachers into the profession. So getting them into the teacher ed programs, getting them to alternative certification programs. And then from there, we want to keep them. Some schools, some districts have made progress in getting males there, but they've often talked about not retaining them. Part of our mission is to provide a support system and a network and give them an opportunity to learn from each other, so feel like they're being supported so that we can retain them in the profession. So we want to pique their interest at a younger age, recruit them, and retain them.
As you were growing up and then as you were learning your profession, did you have black male role models in education?
I didn't. I would say in my whole entire schooling career, I've had about three. And
you're digging,
I'm digging back pretty far.
When you're the only black male teacher in a school, that has to come with some expectations. What has been your experience around that in terms of what you are expected to be able to achieve with your students?
For one, for me, from my own personal experience, is to be the sort of disciplinarian in the school. Because you're the one black male in the building, all the students whose other teachers are struggling with, they assume and put them in your class, but you're going to have that magic wand and you're going to fix any issues or concerns that the student may have.
Do you think it's because you're black or you're male?
I think it's both. And in particular, when you're working in a urban district where the majority of students are African-American, I think there's an assumption just because you're black and you're male, you're going to have this magic wand, and you're going to be able to fix any problems that you have, fix any of those issues in your classroom. And one of the things that we're trying to dispel this myth is that just because you're a black male doesn't mean that you have all the answers. It doesn't mean that you don't need the same support as any other teacher. Because oftentimes the idea is that when you walk into a building, you're a black male, that you have it. Hmm. And that's just not true. And so one of the things we want to talk about is, and one of the things that we do is we provide the support. Like, black males just don't walk into the building and know the answers. They need just as much support as other people. That's often not the case. And so then you have people leaving because they're tired. It's almost like you're the dean of culture or the dean of discipline while being a teacher in your own classroom.
I hear that. Now, there are, as you know, a number of indicators pointing to this probably being one of the most difficult times to recruit teachers. You got people leaving the profession in large numbers. Pay is stagnant or going down, and school districts are struggling. How does the Black Male Educators Alliance of Michigan go up against all that and win in terms of recruiting young men of color to be teachers?
Let me put this out here, right? The big elephant in the room, but I'm sure everyone would agree with, we got to pay teachers more. You know, I'm a huge advocate for that, and I will continue to do what I can and kind of push that. But in the meantime, one of the things we got to do is we got to figure out how do we make this more about helping to build the community, helping to support the community. Some folks will talk about the issues of education and equity as a civil rights issue of today, right? Some people argue against that. Some people argue for that. And I think really reaching out to the hearts of folks and saying, why does this important work and how does this work affect, like, not only like the students but the larger community and our country as a whole? It's almost like, why do we recruit people to go into the military or to be police officers or to be firemen? And some of those people are some of the lowest paid folks or occupations that we have. But folks going there not because I'm here to make money, but I'm here to help. I'm here to do a service. And so one of the things we do is we talk to the heart of people and talk about why this work is important. And yeah, it's not the most lucrative job initially, but over time, not only will pay come, because there is opportunity for leadership where we do get paid very decent in this profession, but there's just opportunities to help people, right? And there's no cost that you could put on that. And so really, really reaching out to the heart of folks and getting people to understand that, yes, it's a difficult time to be a teacher. And with this, just the policies and things that are put on teachers now, helping people understand how this work can be enjoyable. And I think also we just got to do a better job overall in particular school districts, which I really focus on in my school, is making this an enjoyable place to work and having fun at work, because this job is difficult and it's stressful. But how do we make that environment a fun environment where people are engaged in learning and people are also helping our students become better citizens and preparing them to be great citizens for this country and for the world? So I think it's all of that. I can't come to someone and compete with engineers or other folks who may start off close to six figures, where teachers are averaging $40,000 or so starting off, and folks have bachelor's and master's degrees. So how do we convince people that, yeah, the money will come, but until then, here's where you can have fun, where you can feel like you're giving back. That's just like we do with the military or other places where, you know, there's a lot of work and they don't necessarily get compensated for the work that they do.
Dr. Lewis, what do you see as the greatest threat to the academic success of black youth?
That's a good question. Poverty affects not only black students, it affects students who are in poverty, right? Like, whether it's black kids, white kids, Latino kids, like all kids who are suffering from issues of poverty, that can affect their success, right? So I don't think we do a good enough job of addressing those issues in schools. But I'll put that to the side, if I may, and focus more so on, like, the quality of teaching and the way we do school. I think we have to begin to look at how are we engaging kids in the academic learning piece. We have a very 19th century mindset, 20th century mindset for teaching when we need to be really focusing on 21st century skills. And I think because we're so focused on kids producing these test scores and not producing humans who are really focused on learning about themselves, being inquisitive, being innovative, being creative, the way we're approaching education is, I guess, the biggest detriment to the academic success of students in general. But in particularly students of color, I say also sort of held back further because of that, because they're often put in schools in urban districts that are not performing very well or are not even on the cutting edge of these new innovations and things and ways of teaching. That's one of the things that we talk about as well, is not only just getting quality black males in schools, but quality people in schools that are willing to push the thinking and the way we think about school and how we do school.
Dr. Curtis Lewis is the principal of Henry Ford Academy School for Creative Studies in Midtown Detroit and the founder and chairman of the board of the Black Male Educators Alliance of Michigan. Dr. Lewis, thank you so much for being with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you so much.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Still to come, 4,600 children and counting missing from foster care.
There are numerous cases where a kid has disappeared and a foster family has continued cashing checks and nobody even knows that the child is gone or missing.
We'll be back right after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Nearly 13,000 children are in foster care in Michigan, according to the Department of Health and Human Services. And across the country, there are some 400,000 kids in foster care on any given day. But what we don't know for sure is how many children have been lost in foster care. Shenandoah Sheffalo knows how easily that can happen. The Traverse City-based author and advocate put herself into foster care when she was 13. It was the only way she could think of to escape her abusive parents. But it wasn't long before she realized if she disappeared, nobody would care. Nobody would come looking for her. Today, she leads a grassroots project called Hashtag 4600 and Counting, aimed at finding those lost children. Shenandoah, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me on.
Your memoir, Garbage Bag Suitcase, is a powerful, unsettling read, which it should be. It tells the story of your childhood and how you wound up at the age of 13 asking, please put me in foster care. Could you give us an idea of what was going on with your father and mother up to that point?
Yeah, well, I had never known my biological father, so he had never been a part of my life. Through that time, I didn't find my biological father until after I turned 18 and was out of the system. And prior to that, I had lived with my mother and, in fact, had been born in San Diego, California. But we had moved over 50 times across the country, 35 schools before I finally graduated from high school. And it was what I think is a pretty typical foster care experience in that lots of dysfunction, lots of mental illness, lots of drug and alcohol abuse and addiction on my mother's part, lots of men in and out of my mom's life and thus my life. And it was dysfunction as we all know and love it. But it was a story that I really wanted to keep a secret from myself and from the world. It wasn't something I wanted to share because it was so painful. When you go through those experiences, you find yourself even as a child, you know, wondering what you had done to ever deserve those sorts of things. And so for me, the idea of sharing this story really came to fruition in my professional life, watching clients in my office at the time working at a criminal defense office who were sort of on that revolving criminal justice wheel, who often disclosed that they had spent time in foster care. Mm. And I thought, gosh, this is Traverse City and it's such a small community. How come so many of our clients could have spent time in foster care? And so that really set me on the wheel of wanting to start to share my story, with the idea that if I share the story, right, everyone's always interested in what I call the car accident or train wreck of someone's life. If they would stick around and we could talk about what we need to do to fix it and how the foster care is at the core of so many other social issues that most of us care about in our communities.
Shenandoah, you endured terrible, terrible abuse as a child. It is heartbreaking to read the things that were done to you. And then at 13, you decided to enter the foster care system. Now, tell us what those years were like for you.
Well, you know, I was a 13-year-old girl, and I thought that the foster care system was going to be the answer. You know, I had ideas of Annie and Daddy Warbucks sort of floating around my 13-year-old brain. And I really thought that it was going to be a place where, listen, we've picked the best people our state has to offer to become foster parents, right? They've had background checks, they've gone through classes and training. And so I thought that's what I would get. Unfortunately for me, it was just sort of more of the same. You know, there's this comic, Monroe Martin, who talks about his experience in foster care. And he says, if you don't know what foster care is, it's where we take kids who are in dysfunctional and abusive family situations, and we remove them from that, and we place them in the exact same situation, but with total strangers. And, you know, I mean, he does it. He's a comedian, right?
Yeah.
But it's really raw and really true at the same time. I mean, that's what makes him so brilliant, is that for me, it was just more of the same. I never fit in. I was never sort of doing what I was supposed to be doing. I could always be doing more. I knew I wasn't part of the family. And some of that was at the whim of foster parents that I lived with. And part of that was, you know, state rules and guidelines that don't allow foster kids to do certain things. You know, you couldn't be part of family photos. You couldn't go on family trips that were outside of the state without permission. You couldn't have sleepovers at friends' house because their parents weren't licensed foster care workers. I mean, sort of all those things that would give you a normal childhood
yeah.
are taken from you. And you're trying to navigate that. Even at 13, as the person who called and put myself into care, I didn't understand all the consequences of what that would be.
And then take us through what happened through foster care. Did you finally age out?
I aged out of foster care, which for me, I turned 18 halfway through my senior year of high school, which means that at midnight, you're done. You're cut loose from the system. And which is why we see that most foster youth who age out will end up homeless. Half the boys will end up with a felony conviction before 19 and a half, and half the girls will end up pregnant before 19 and a half. So it's a large portion. So in my case, I was going to turn 18 halfway through my senior year. All I really wanted was to graduate from high school. I hadn't known anyone who had graduated from high school. That was a big deal for me. And so I was trying to figure out how I was going to do that, how I could stay in school until May to graduate from high school. And on my way to my part-time minimum wage job one day, I thought, well, what if I just offered to pay my foster parents the amount they had been receiving from the state of Michigan? And if I paid them that, would they allow me to just stay until May? Because that would be way cheaper than me trying to get an apartment and a car and transportation and figuring it out. And so I came home from work and asked them, and we ran the numbers, and we realized that if I worked 25 hours a week at my minimum wage, I would barely have enough after taxes to pay them. But they agreed. And so that agreement bought me that extra 6 months of time to graduate from high school. So I worked full time, you know, almost full time at that job, went to school, and was able to get myself to graduate from high school. So that's how I managed some time. During that 6 months, I had a teacher who asked me what my plan was after high school graduation. And I vividly remember telling her, I'm just going to get more hours at this. I was working at a hardware store at the time, at this hardware store. They really like me there. The manager said he'll give me more hours. I could get myself on a management track. And that was my big plan after high school. She thought I should apply to college, which was really the first time in my life anyone had ever even talked about college. She sent me to my guidance counselor's office, and I walked in his office, and he looked me square in the eye and said, you know, Shen, people like you don't go to college. People like you learn to serve people like me.
Whoa.
And I thought, yeah. And I thought, gosh, you're absolutely right. I mean, people, when I say that phrase to people, you know, I hear a lot of, oh my goodness, or that's crazy, or who could ever say that? But the truth was that 18-year-old girl sitting across from him absolutely agreed with him. I had heard that countless times, you know, social workers, caseworkers, foster parents, judges, every adult surrounding me was essentially waiting for me to turn into my mother.
Boy.
That was the quest held out for me. You know, my mom had two children by the time she was 21, never graduated from high school, had been married, you know, four or five times. I've sort of have lost count. And had this alcohol drug addiction. She had a mental illness. So I thought, listen, at some point, I'm just turning into that. And that was my goal for myself. That was surely everyone else's goal for me. And luckily for me, when I walked back down to my teacher's room and told her the story, you know, her head looked like an 80s horror movie that it was going to spin around and pop off of her body. And she helped me fill out college applications. So much so that when she realized I couldn't afford the application fee, she's the one who eventually stepped up and wrote the $125 check to Michigan State University so I could apply. I eventually got in, and I thought that was going to be my saving grace, right? Like, I got into college, I had a dorm, I had some place to live, and it turned out that it wasn't. And that's where I started having this realization that I could disappear and nobody would even come looking for me. Nobody would even know that I was gone.
But we should tell everybody, and as you learn in reading your memoir, Garbage Bag Suitcase, you did beat the odds. You became one of the only 1% of all foster care kids who graduate from college. You live with your husband and daughter in Traverse City. And it is a story really worth reading. And now you've kind of launched this petition on change.org called #4600 and counting. What's the significance of that name?
So the significance is that every year the child welfare system loses about 1%, 1.1% of the kids in the child welfare system. So we have somewhere between 4,600 kids that no one knows where they are. So state authorities, you know, have taken control of these kids, have removed them from their homes. And they have just sort of miraculously disappeared into the system. And this started when someone on social media shared with me an article out of Kansas about three girls who had disappeared. And ultimately, some state senators were interested in why and had called, you know, and had this big congressional hearing about why these girls were missing. And the article shook me to my core so much. Not because kids were missing. I knew kids had run away and gone missing before. We've seen the headlines, you know, kids found strangled or dead, you know, from the foster care system. I knew that was happening. What shook me to my core was it seemed to just be acceptable by all the people in power. It was sort of stated in the article, well, listen, in Kansas, we're missing roughly 73 kids, and that's less than 1.1% of our state foster care population. So we're beating the national average. We're doing fine. Hmm. And it was just sort of the non-caring nature of the somehow the fact that even one kid was missing wasn't one kid too many that just really sort of punched me in my gut. And then I started looking at the numbers. The article then later referenced that there are 4,600 kids missing in 2017 so far. And I reached out to another homeless youth advocate that I knew in Toronto. And I said, I mean, why is nobody talking about this? If you statistically run the numbers, that means they're losing 88 kids a week.
And I think those of us who you know, kind of have that assumption that, well, they're being cared for, just how are kids lost in the foster care system?
Oh, in all sorts of ways. Obviously, the number one way is by running away, that kids will run away from a foster home. Now, kids run away all the time. Kids run away from, you know, their biological parents' home. Kids run away. It's something they do. The problem is that in foster care, nobody goes to look for them. A kid may run away. A foster parent may or may not report that. A caseworker may or may not report that. And then that's sort of the end of it. Even if that child's reported to authorities, nobody's out there sort of beating the bushes looking for the kid. Now, I have a 15-year-old daughter, and if she ran away, you know, I would have posters up. I would sort of be the person leading the march. And that's part of the problem. There's nobody leading the march for these kids. And so they disappear. And what we know is especially for girls who run away, is that within 48 hours, they will be approached by sex traffickers on the streets. It's a proven statistic. We know that a lot of the kids that disappear from foster care wind up in human trafficking and human sex trafficking rings and organizations.
So what is the whole point of hashtag 4600 and counting? What kind of shape is it taking?
Yeah, it's been amazing to watch the stories pour in from people who have children who have been missing from the foster care system. And more importantly for us, it's about changing what happens. So what we want to see happen is that when a kid enters foster care, that we basically would put together a safety kit for them, that they'd have their photo taken, that that photo would be updated every 6 months that they're in care, that we would have some sort of DNA swab taken, and that we have some medical and dental records on that child. So that if they do go missing, we are able to do what we would do for any other child or something that any parent would do for their child, which is put a poster together, put an alert out to be on the lookout for all of those things. What we're finding is that authorities sometimes are finding children, both dead and alive, that they can't identify because there's no record of them. So that, yes, they've been in the child welfare system, but we don't have any DNA. We don't have any updated photos. We don't have any of those things to help us even identify bodies. And so part of what 4600 and counting is doing is bringing the awareness, letting people know that this is a problem and something we need to address, but also that we need to change the way in which we're approaching the situation. So we want to have these safety kits. And then we want to be able to have caseworkers checking in to make sure that these kids are where they're supposed to be. And we hear oftentimes from caseworkers, and we know that they're overworked. They have too many kids on their caseloads. They can't keep track of everyone. And we're just suggesting, hey, we could bring in some technology to help. It's really easy to Skype or FaceTime with people. Can you do a 5-minute, you know, Skype or FaceTime with the family and the child at least every 30 days so that we're checking to make sure these kids are accounted for? Because there are numerous cases where a kid has disappeared and a foster family has continued cashing checks and nobody even knows that the child is gone or missing.
How can people help if they want to? What can people do?
The fastest and easiest way is to log on to change.org and sign the petition. We would love for people to share the video that Marnie and myself put together talking about our own journey, what happened to me, what happened to her. Marnie has a similar story, although she didn't choose foster care the way I did it at 13. At 13, she chose to hit the streets instead and was raped and abused numerous times and lived the life on the streets and understands that really well and understands what that looks like really well. So we got to find the balance of privacy and saving children's lives. And the only way we can do that, that I know how to do that, is by making some noise and making people aware of the situation and getting as many signatures on the petition we can. So both the head of Health and Human Services in the U.S. and the president and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will take a look at it and realize that this is a cause that we need to put some effort and energy behind.
And it certainly seems, just from reading your book, Garbage Bag Suitcase, and hearing you talk, this is also a battle cry to change what you see. Someone who's been through the foster care system, it's broken and it needs fixing.
Well, it's not just broken, it's shattered, right? In my view, we need to make sure that these children are at the core of what we're trying to do to fix it. Because somewhere along the line, we've lost the idea that all these numbers and statistics are beating hearts in real people who grow up. I mean, every child in care is going to grow up and be an adult. And then when they're not acting in a way that we deem socially acceptable, we're going to want to take action against that, right? We're going to want to try to put them in jail or prison to reform their behavior. We're going to want to try to ask, well, why is that mom having all of these children? Why is this mom on welfare? Why is all of this? Why won't they just work? Why won't they just do this? And the answer lies behind not what their current behavior is showing us, but what has happened to them And I think we've somehow forgotten that these are children who are abused and mistreated. Nobody comes into foster care because things are great at home. Everyone comes in because something really terrible has happened to them. And we have to really help them heal that if we're going to have better outcomes in the future.
You can go to change.org and search for hashtag 4600 and counting to learn more about this effort from my guest, Shenandoah Sheffalo. Her book is Garbage Bag Suitcase. Shenandoah, thanks for being with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me on.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio.